You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to Issues Etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love Issues Etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. C.S. Lewis is, I would say, probably one of those tip-of-the-tongue names that Christians, especially English-speaking Christians, always have there. If you say, name a 20th century Christian thinker, writer, he is indeed, in some senses, a lay theologian, they're going to come up with a couple, and at the top of that list, at the tip of their tongue, will be the name C.S. Lewis. Now, he's known for a lot of things, mostly his delving into English literature, that was his vocation, and his authorship of remarkable works, including Mere Christianity and works of fiction as well. He's not known for his political thought. In fact, many would argue that he rejected notions of politics and that he rejected notions like natural law. Is that entirely true? Joining us to talk about C.S. Lewis on politics and public affairs, Dr. Justin Buckley Dyer. He's Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri-Columbia. He's co-author of the new book, C.S. Lewis on Politics and the Natural Law. Dr. Dyer, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Usually, C.S. Lewis is sometimes celebrated, in fact, as a apolitical man. Is that entirely true?
Well, it's not entirely true. Lewis, I think, liked to cultivate a perception of being apolitical, and some of the people closest to him often commented about how much he loathed politics and how much he was uninterested in public affairs. And there's at least some evidence for that. Lewis, in his own life, often talked about how he hated great issues. He bragged about never reading a newspaper. There was a time when he actually turned down an offer to be an honorary commander of the British Empire from Winston Churchill. And in his letter to the Prime Minister's office, he said that there are knaves who say and fools who believe that all of my religious writings are really covert anti-leftist propaganda. And he thought that his appearance on the list, as he said, would strengthen their hand. And so there's a way, I think, that Lewis was really weary of having his religious writings and his Christian apologetics linked with any kind of partisan political cause. And so he deliberately, I think, tried to distance his writing and his reputation from politics, and he didn't want it to get embroiled in the political causes of his day. On the other hand, I think Lewis's writings are deeply political, and once you start to look into it, you can see how political many of the things that he wrote actually were. And in fact, when you look into his background and his education and his teaching, you see that the themes of the canon of Western political philosophy are present everywhere. So part of it, I think, just requires that we step back and ask what it means really to be political. And if by political we mean that he was interested in parliamentary intrigue and the sausage-making of public policy, we'd say, no, Lewis was probably not that political. But if by political we mean interested in the truths of human nature and how they come out in public affairs and in our political debates, then I think we would have to say that Lewis was actually deeply political and that there are political themes throughout his work.
And he lived in very interesting political times, kind of at the center of a very interesting political situation, and yet he was wary of that involvement. How would you describe his wariness?
Well, certainly in terms of interesting political times, Lewis came of age and was drafted then as a 18-year-old into World War I, and he fought and he was wounded in World War One. He then, of course, was writing and was a public intellectual at the time of World War Two. And so thinking about what's going on in the world when Lewis is alive, these are very interesting and troubling political times. And so the question, what was Lewis weary about exactly? I think that he saw his own vocation and his work to be in academia, first and foremost. He was a scholar of English literature and Renaissance literature, but then also as a public face of Christianity. And so he didn't want that work to be associated with politics. But on the other hand, there's no way to really avoid talking about public affairs and politics. One of the ways that I was introduced to Lewis was by reading Mere Christianity when I was in high school. And as you know, and many of your listeners will know, that book was originally delivered as a series of broadcast talks on the BBC during World War II. And Lewis was asked to introduce the British people to Christianity, or reintroduce them to Christianity, to give a kind of overview of what Christians believe. And so it starts out by trying to just describe Christianity, but he gets into natural law theory. He talks about social morality. He has a time where he talks a bit about patriotism and other things. And so even these kinds of themes start to creep into ostensibly just Christian talks or religious talks. So it's very hard to separate these things out, I think, in Lewis's work.
It's almost impossible for our conversation to proceed without discussing a work that runs through your book on him, and that is The Abolition of Man. Introduce us to this work, and why is it so important for the subject at hand?
Well, right around the same time that Lewis was doing his broadcast talks on the BBC, this is right in the middle of World War II in 1943, Lewis publishes a book called The Abolition of Man. And The Abolition of Man starts out as a series of lectures at the University of Edinburgh, and it is essentially a takedown of a high school English language textbook. And the English language textbook that Lewis picks up, he's actually asked to review it, teaches something about how we use language. And the basic thesis of the book that Lewis is reviewing is that when we describe things about the external world, what we're really doing is describing something about our own feelings. And this is what the book is teaching to students of the English language. It's trying to tell them how to understand how we use language. And what Lewis picks up on is how much of what this book is saying, if people believed it and if students imbibed its teaching, would undercut the great tradition that we have in the Western world, and that really is at the foundation of our political institutions, that tells us that there really are things that are true and good and beautiful in the world, and that it really has nothing about whether or not our emotional responses to those things are a certain way. So there are objective moral realities in the world, in other words. And Lewis spends a great deal of time trying to show why that philosophy goes wrong and why there are truly objective realities in the world. And this book then becomes a kind of classic for C.S. Lewis. And it winds up on National Review's list of the 100 greatest books of the 20th century. It's number 7 on their list. And I think there's a kind of puzzle here. National Review, for those who don't know who are listening, is one of the flagship, or the flagship, journal of the American conservative political movement, started by William F. Buckley in the middle of the 20th century. And so for the flagship political magazine in the United States to list the number 7 greatest book of the 20th century as a book that starts out as a series of lectures on an English language textbook in 1943, it's kind of an odd connection. But what Lewis touches on in that book, I think the fundamental reality and importance of objective morality and the political implications of our rejection of that, I think is deeply prescient, that it tells us a lot about what happens in World War II, what happens after World War II, and I think probably tells us a lot about our current predicament right now in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world.
So was Lewis, even in that work, at least by the time he's done with it, was he struggling against nascent postmodernism, the beginning of postmodernism?
Sure. I think postmodernism is certainly one of the things that he's talking about. And postmodernism, I think at a fundamental level, says something like there is no overarching narrative or truth about the world that we live in. And all we really have are the stories that we tell about it. And Lewis is certainly struggling against that, and he would certainly think that that's false, that there is a kind of true overarching narrative about the world that we live in, and that that's important. But he's also struggling against what we might call modernism. And that, so not only postmodernism, but in his day, it was modernism or the general outlook that saw matter as the only thing that was real, and the scientific method as the only way to come to knowledge about the world. And that was certainly one of the dominant outlooks in his time and one of the things that he often argued against. And this was part of his defense of these metaphysical concepts, so not physical concepts such as beauty, truth, and goodness that we all, I think, understand through our own experiences but are tempted to rule out based on this modern or even postmodern outlook that has so infected modern society.
We're talking about C.S. Lewis on Politics and Public Affairs on this Wednesday afternoon, October the 19th. Dr. Justin Buckley Dyer is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk about Lewis's view of natural law as framed by creation.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
When pastors talk about us, they call us ad crucem. When laity mention us, they speak of ad crucem. When non-Lutherans address us, they say ADC Rucam. But no matter how you say it, ad crucem is the place to go for greeting cards, artwork, jewelry, ornaments, housewares, church certificates, church banners, and all your gift-buying needs. Visit adcrucem.com, confessing the faith through art and word. ADCRUCEM.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lewis's service book has been in use now for an entire decade, and we at Concordia Theological Seminary felt it was a good time to give some consideration of what we've learned in the process of using that hymnal for 10 years.
Dr. Paul Grimm talking about the Good Shepherd Institute Conference, November 6th through the 8th, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're bringing together a number of people who were involved in the project, as well as other pastors and musicians who have used the hymnal for 10 years, with the goal that together we can consider even more deeply how this hymnal has affected our church body in its gathering together Sunday after Sunday as we receive the gifts of God in the divine service and return our thanks and praise for his wondrous deeds.
Lutheran Service Book at 10 Years is the theme for the 17th Annual Good Shepherd Institute Conference, November 6th through the 8th, at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, visit ctsfw.edu or call 262-452-2224. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about C.S. Lewis on Politics and Public Affairs. Dr. Justin Buckley Dyer is our guest, co-author of the new book, C.S. Lewis on Politics and the Natural Law. Speaking of natural law, Dr. Dyer, you say that Lewis's view here can really only be understood as framed, and including not only natural law, but human nature, as framed by the fact of having been created.
This is one of the difficulties, I think, of reading and understanding Lewis. On the one hand, for the listeners who know his works well, he did want to make a case for natural law that was not tied on the surface to Christianity. And so in The Abolition of Man, for example, he always refers to the natural law as the Tao, and he even tries to take it out of the Western context. On the other hand, I think if we understand Lewis, we would understand, as Walter Hooper said of him, that he was the most thoroughly converted man that he ever met. And Lewis himself even said that he believes in Christianity, like he believes in the sun, not because he ever sees it directly, but because by it he sees everything else. And so there's a way in which I think Lewis truly does see everything else in light of what he took to be the revealed truths of Christianity. And the fundamental truth was that we were created. And so Lewis's understanding of creation means that we're created in a certain way, that human beings have certain inbuilt purposes, that we have a purpose in our own lives and a way that we ought to live. And the second aspect, something he says in Mere Christianity, is that we don't actually live that way, that there's something wrong with us, that the world is broken and fallen. And those two truths about human nature for Lewis, that we're created good and created to flourish with purposes, but that we don't actually achieve it in our own lives and that we fall short in some way. He says those are the keys to understanding or to all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe that we live in. And I remember when I read that as a high school student, I thought that seems like a pretty important claim, and one worth considering and investigating, if this really is the key to all clear thinking about the universe that we live in.
Was Lewis a defender, or would he have been a defender of the idea, the existence of natural law?
He certainly would have been a defender of the idea of natural law. And to think about what this means exactly, I think it is at root a really basic concept. The idea of natural is not exactly what we think about today when people talk about natural law or when moral philosophers talk about natural law. What we mean by natural when we say that is that it has something to do with human nature, and specifically the highest aspect of human nature, which is our reason. The second aspect is law, or the idea that it would be lawful or obligatory on us in some way. The basic claim of the tradition is that we can know and understand certain things about human nature and how we ought to live through reason. And then secondly, that it's obligatory on us, that we really are morally obligated in some way to live that way. And that claim, I think, is really important, and it helps us make sense of all sorts of other things. How is it that we think that we have certain moral duties to each other? How is it that individuals can have natural rights or individual rights, fundamental basic rights, just because they're human beings? How is it that we have a certain understanding of the kinds of political institutions that are most conducive to human flourishing? And I think all of those questions presuppose some understanding of natural law, and without it, they really are imperiled.
He was a proponent of natural law at a time when there were Christian scholars who were opposed to it or were uneasy with the idea. Talk about that, if you would.
This is one of the debates within Christianity itself. I mentioned when I was describing natural law that one of the assumptions is that human reason, or through the exercise of our reason, that we could come to know certain things about the world and about ourselves and about morality. Some Christians, I think, influenced particularly by a dark view of human nature and a certain view of the fall, think that human reason is itself totally unreliable, that there is no way that we could come to any understanding about how we ought to live or what's good simply through the exercise of our reason, that it all comes through revelation or through command from God. So the theologian that most represents this tradition and the theologian that Lewis sparred with in his writings was Karl Barth, a Swiss Reformed theologian, who took a very different lesson away from World War II. One of the things that Lewis thought was that if Nazi morality was wrong, and if British morality or notions of morality in Britain were at least better in some way than Nazi morality, then, as he said, there had to be something, some true morality for them to be better about. Karl Barth's solution was not to go in that direction. His was to turn strictly to the command of God revealed in Scripture and to criticize Nazism on that basis and that basis alone. And so this created a kind of rift, particularly in Protestant Christianity, over the legacy of the natural law tradition and whether it had a place within Christian ethics.
How did Lewis explain the fact that natural law had fallen out of favor in mainstream political thought?
he diagnoses the way that we got to this predicament. And he, in many of his writings, he will go back and look at the changes in political thought that begin really in the 16th century and later. And I think he roots the causes for natural laws falling out of favor partly with the modern turn and the two philosophies that we had talked about earlier with modernism and postmodernism. But there had been many people, and certainly in Lewis's day, who simply denied that there was anything beyond the material world, that matter was all that existed, and that matter was all that we needed to explain our own existence. And one of the things that was very influential and something that Lewis thought about was the theory of evolution and Charles Darwin's theory of evolution and how it ostensibly made sense of human life and even human reason in a way that had no need for a theistic conception. Lewis thought ultimately that that explanation didn't work, that it wasn't satisfactory, and that there would be a need to go back and to rediscover the answers that had been, you know, long been part of the Western tradition and part of Christianity generally, that actually we were created, that reason is something independent and separate from the material world, and that through this kind of recovery of reason, we would actually find our way back to a point of sanity.
He actually traced the consequences of this in studies of English literature, didn't he?
He did. He was a scholar of English literature, and so his magnum opus was a book that was the Oxford History of English Literature for a series at Oxford. It's called English Literature in the 16th Century. And he was very good at tracing trends in political thought and in religious thought, and he particularly was very critical of John Calvin and Calvin's theology. I think if we read Lewis, we're often startled, or we should be startled, I think, in the terms that he used to describe Calvin's thought. And so, for example, there are passages where Lewis, in multiple places, describes Calvinism as akin to devil worship. And what he meant by that, and what he's actually talking about, is he thought that there was a way, a certain way of understanding Calvin's thought that would lead us to worship God on no other account than his power, that it would be power for the sake of power, and that's the principle that Lewis associated with devil worship. His solution was to link God's power with God's goodness and to say that God is inherently good, that's part of who he is, and that our reason can understand or participate in God's reason to some extent at least in appreciating that goodness and the goodness in our world. And so it sounds, I think, like high philosophy. But for Lewis, it had very practical consequences, and practical consequences they would see even in the political world.
Did he see, then, natural law as an expression of God's intrinsic goodness?
Yes, I think ultimately he did. And so we would probably distinguish, and Lewis also would distinguish between how we know and what we know, and then ultimately what its foundation is. Lewis thought one of the promises of natural law is that it allowed citizens to talk about human purpose and meaning and goodness in a way that didn't require agreement on religious grounds. And so you could talk across religious traditions, you could talk potentially across cultures, because it was rooted in a common human nature. If you push Lewis, though, on where exactly does that come from, how can we explain this common human nature and why it is that we can reason about these things, he would certainly have said that ultimately it's because it's an expression of God's goodness and it's built into the very fabric of the world that we live in.
You say that in terms of particular politics, Lewis drew heavily upon kind of classic liberal tradition, John Locke.
Lewis was an interesting character in that sense. You read some of his things, you read his diagnosis of the modern world, you read how much he appreciated the ancients, and you might expect that he would advocate a return to some kind of ancient conception of politics or political organization, and in fact, he doesn't at all. We could describe him, I think, fairly as being part of the liberal tradition, and by liberal tradition I just mean that tradition that emphasizes liberty, limited government, individual rights, that comes from the writings of the English political theorist John Locke and others. And Lewis certainly, I think, fits into that tradition. When you hear his own explanations of political issues and how he would advocate for them in the public sphere. I think he is, in some sense, a classical liberal like John Locke or like John Stuart Mill and some of the others that he found influential.
Dr. Justin Buckley Dyer is our guest. We're talking about C.S. Lewis on politics and public affairs on this Wednesday, October the 19th. A few more minutes with him on the other side of the break. We'll talk a little bit about how these ideas found their way into C.S. Lewis's fiction as well. Then Dr. Thomas Korchak joins us for part five of our series, Classroom Apologetics. We'll be in the Education 101 classroom.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about C.S. Lewis on politics and public affairs. Dr. Justin Buckley Dyer is our guest, co-author of the new book, C.S. Lewis on Politics and Natural Law. You'll find a link to this at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Dyer, you were speaking before, and we've spoken extensively here about the abolition of man, essentially an essay, but Lewis is known equally well for his works of fiction, his space trilogy, the Narnia works as well, and you say that at least by way of presentation, these ideas found their way into his fiction. Let's begin with the space trilogy.
In Lewis's space trilogy, he has one of his novels in that trilogy, which is That Hideous Strength. And in the preface to That Hideous Strength, Lewis notes that he's making the exact same argument in that book as the one that he made in The Abolition of Man. And he says that there's a reason now that he's doing it as a kind of fairy tale for grown-ups, and it's that that's how he can communicate it to a different audience. Lewis, towards the end of his life, I think despaired about the ability of reasoned arguments to actually shape culture. And it's not that he didn't think there was a place for them. Certainly he did. He engaged in them. He was part of the academic world and the currency in that world is rational argument. But he also sought to shape a broader culture, and he did that by embedding his arguments in fiction. He comments in several places about the reason why he does this, but one of the memorable ways that he thought about it was he said that he needed to be able to steal past those watchful dragons that modern society erects against reasoned arguments. And the way that you do that is by influencing people's imagination. And Lewis wrote fiction. He wrote stories that would teach moral lessons, but they didn't do so in the style of a moral treatise or a philosophical treatise. And this is a lens that I think that helps us see the rest of Lewis's works and helps us appreciate the degree to which he was still articulating arguments about natural law, about social organization, about the way we should live together, even in the Space Trilogy, even in the Chronicles of Narnia, even in all of these different works that are on the surface about something much different than politics.
Where in particular would you point as a good example in the Narnia Chronicles to find an example of what you're talking about?
Well, I think if you just think about the Narnia Chronicles as a whole, the story itself involves the founding of a new polity. It involves the children trying to think about whether power is being used for good or for ill. It involves the temptations of power, of political power, the promise of political power to the children. They're thinking through who their ultimate authority will be in life. And so all of these things start to creep in, I think, to the way that Lewis is writing and thinking, even in his works of fiction.
You note that those are intended to be maybe secondary to simply enjoyable fiction. They are also intended to be moral education for the young readers.
Yes, and this goes back a little bit, I think, a key to understanding this in Lewis is even in The Abolition of Man. When he's talking in The Abolition of Man about whether or not things in the external world are objectively good or beautiful, he also, I think, admits that early education is extremely important for teaching us to have the appropriate emotional responses to those things in the world. So in other words, the purpose of early education is to teach the young to love things that are lovable, to appreciate things that are beautiful, to abhor things that truly are evil. And this is one of the things that Lewis is trying to do with his fiction. He's trying to instruct through these stories and to teach people to have the right emotional responses to things that are objectively good and true in the world.
Even though he is a little weary of rational arguments, as you mentioned before, he did highly value the rule of reason, didn't he?
Absolutely. So he's not skeptical at all about reason or the importance of reason. What he was skeptical about was a culture that he thought did not value reason, and then the ability of those arguments to be persuasive to that culture. That there was something that was guarding against the power of reason. There was something that was preventing people from understanding. And that something often had to do with their own emotional dispositions and their own moral vices that people had come to peace with. And so one of the things that Lewis wanted to do was he wanted to help shape culture in a positive direction, but do it through fiction and not always do it simply through trying to have the best rational argument.
Even though he's not overtly political or a political activist, is it going too far to say that he is a covert activist?
No, I don't think it would be too far to say that. And actually, there was an article in Christianity Today about a year ago that suggested, and I don't know if this is true or if it has come out or not, that Lewis may have actually been a covert agent during World War II in some of his activities, actually working for the government. But even if that's not true, if he wasn't covert in that sense, certainly he was covert in the sense that he was trying to influence the ideas that shape cultures. And those things ultimately would influence politics. Lewis was not interested in being involved in partisan politics. He did not electioneer. He maintained independence from politics. He didn't give money to political candidates or anything that he thought had a political cause. But on the other hand, he invested a great amount of time and energy into trying to educate, into trying to shape people to think about the world in ways that were true, and certainly spent a lot of time on Christian apologetics. And at one point, Lewis did say that the most political act that someone could do is converting their neighbor. And there was a sense, and he even articulated it in that way, that evangelism was itself a kind of political act because of the way it shapes culture. And judged by those standards, we'd have to say Lewis was one of the most political men of the 20th century.
How successful would you say he was stealing past those watchful dragons?
In my own case, he was very successful. I don't know if he stole past the watchful dragons because it was actually one of his pieces of nonfiction that influenced me, but as a high school student when I picked up Mere Christianity, it had a big impact on me, and the chapter on natural law was really persuasive. The fact that he's still being read, the fact that his books sell in the millions every year and continue to sell in the millions every year, that he's one of the few 20th century authors that is still read to that extent, I think, does underscore just the influence that he had. But some of that influence has been, as you mentioned, in his works of fiction, and that's, in fact, I think, what he's most known for. And so many, many people know the Chronicles of Narnia and have read those stories without ever realizing just how deeply allegorical they are about the Christian life and about the overarching narrative of Christian revelation. And so they're introduced to those things without really thinking about them on the surface. And so in that sense, I think he's been extremely successful in carrying out the strategy that he thought through.
Dr. Justin Buckley-Dyer is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri, Columbia, co-author of the new book, C.S. Lewis on Politics and the Natural Law. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Dyer, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All through the last couple of weeks, we have been walking through a series called Classroom Apologetics. And I view it as kind of walking down the halls of the average college or university classroom building. You come upon your English classroom, your history classroom, your philosophy classroom. We come next, and in the next 45 minutes or so, to the Education 101 classroom.
What are the theories of education that are prevailing there? Are they hostile in some way to the Christian mind and the Christian faith? And are they good methods of educating children, whether they be young children or old children? Dr. Thomas Korchak joins us, author of the book Lutheran Education from Wittenberg to the Future, for part five of our series Classroom Apologetics today, Education 101.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.